Someone who was at Quantico when some of the Raiders were training there. He had seen them work all day, and then he was in the gym just shooting around some baskets that night. And here the Raiders came in to start 10 o'clock at night to work until 2 o'clock in the morning on calisthenics and sparring and knife fighting. We're talking 25, 50 miles, full packs. We're talking about resting just a few minutes and then turning around and doing the same thing, going over the same terrain at night so that they would learn to function as well in darkness as in daytime. They had to become excellent swimmers, excellent boatsmen. They worked on marksmanship practically round the clock. It was just a very, very intense training.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. At the beginning of World War II, military planners set out to form the most ruthless, skilled, and effective force the world had ever seen. The U.S. Marines were already the world's greatest fighters, but leadership wanted a select group to conduct special operations at the highest level in the Pacific theater. And so the Marine Raiders were born. This took place in the context of the island-hopping campaign in the Pacific, where entrenched Japanese forces couldn't simply be bombed or taken out with surface attacks. So they needed a group trained in a different kind of warfare. The Marine Raiders were trained as marksmen, brawlers, tacticians, knife fighters, and they could accomplish their objective before the enemy even knew they were there. They became heroes in the stuff of legend, but even though one of their commanders was President Roosevelt's son, they've mostly disappeared. Due to a number of reasons, partly because the Marine Raiders as a unit disbanded before the war was over, although they've been revived in recent years. To talk about the Marine Raiders is today's guest, Carol Averitt, author of the book Marine Raiders, The True Story of the Legendary World War II Battalions. We look at the personal narratives of four men who served as Marine Raiders, frontline accounts of the Raiders' most important engagements, and the explanation for their obscurity despite their earlier fame. So the legacy of the Marine Raiders lives on today in America's different special forces and also the special forces of other militaries around the world. There's a lot to unpack here, so I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Carol Averitt. Carol, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. It's good to be back.
Yeah. So the last time we talked about the Coffin Corner Boys, a group on a World War II era bomber, and we're going to be shifting from the European to the Pacific theater based on the research you've done for your new book. So before getting into it, what led you to look at the Marine Raiders? Who are they and what caught your attention about them?
Well, I'll tell you, it was kind of one of those interesting, ironic, just little small meetings that turned into something really major. I was at the Villages here in Florida and speaking to a military group up there that I've spoken to a couple of times. And I was actually speaking about Coffin Corner Boys. And during the book signing portion of that meeting, I had this gentleman step up to the table and he said, well, what are you going to do next? And I said, well, I'm casting nets. This was 3 or 4 years ago. I said, I'm casting nets to determine what direction to go in next. And he said, well, have you thought about Marine Raiders? Well, admittedly, at that time, yes, I had heard of Marine Raiders, but like most people, just did not know much about World War II Marine Raiders. So he stepped away. I didn't see him for about 10 or 15 minutes. He came back. He had evidently gone to his house and came back carrying a very worn old tape of a movie that was filmed in 1943 called Gung Ho. And it was loosely based on the World War II Raiders, one of the battalions in particular, Carlson's Raiders. He gave it to me and he said, I want you to watch this and see what you think. Well, I did. It was so interesting. And then just a couple of weeks later, I had a trip to Washington, D.C. to actually research another project. And I thought, well, you know what? While I'm up here in D.C., I'm going to see if I can find out a little bit about these Marine Raiders. So I called the Marine Raider Association, which is a national organization that keeps up with everything Marine Raider oriented. They do a lot of research into the history and so on and so forth. And they said, well, the one person you need to speak to is named Lieutenant Colonel Joe Shushko. He's at Quantico, and he knows everything that there is about World War II Rangers. I said, fine. So I called Colonel Shushko, and he graciously invited me and my husband to come to Quantico, come to a building where he had started gathering just tons of World War II Raider memorabilia. And I stepped into this little unassuming brick building, and I just could not believe every inch of that building was covered with World War II uniforms from the Raiders, their stiletto knives that they were so famous for, the really thin little wicked blades that they used, helmets, boots, letters, photographs. And he allowed me and my husband to sit at a table with maybe 15 or 20 loose leaf notebooks filled with photos and letters, documents. And I'll tell you, he really literally introduced me to the world of World War II Raiders. I entered that building that morning, sort of interested, not really knowing, but I left that building about 4 or 5 hours later that day. And I knew that the next thing I wanted to write about were these amazing warriors that fought in the South Pacific that really have not been up to this point given as much exposure as the other people, the Line Marines, the large divisions that really went on to win that war for us. So, like I say, it started as just a very little small innocuous thing of looking at a 1942, old copy of a 1942 movie about the Raiders, and it just turned into a 4-year dedicated project that culminated in the writing of this book.
Well, something that your book does is focus on the innovations that are happening in the Pacific theater. And in some ways, I think you could argue that in the European theater, there wasn't as much innovation because there didn't need to be. You have the B-17 bomber, which conducts the vast majority of the bombing missions, which is a technology developed in the 30s. In the Pacific theater, because of the vast distances, you need something with much longer range. So that's why the B-29 is developed. It costs more than the Manhattan Project. It was very buggy when it worked, but it could fly for thousands of miles. And it was suitable to fight in the Pacific theater when you need to go such vast distances, or the importance of the aircraft carrier, the importance of submarines. These are all different innovations that are crafted to be able to wage war effectively in the unique conditions of the Pacific theater that are very different from what the United States has fought before. And this is a case, too, with the Marine Raiders. So what were the specific challenges that the U.S. military had in the Pacific theater that necessitated the creation of the Special Operations Force? For whatever reason, current forces were inadequate or not specified enough to address.
Scott, you've really asked an excellent question here. And I'm so glad you brought this up, because it leads exactly into why the Marines needed to have, why the U.S. military needed to have a small, light, amphibious group of special forces that could come into these islands, preferably under the cover of darkness, preferably being launched from submarines. They would come in on their rubber boats, sneak in on the beaches, make their quick, fast, darting raids, and then leave. They were lightly armed so that they could travel very fast, move through the island very quickly before the Japanese were aware of them. And this special forces units that were formed, 4 battalions, the Marine Raiders, fulfilled that bill. And they were especially significant on the actual first D-Day in the South Pacific, when General Vandegrift pulled together his forces to land on Guadalcanal. Edson's first Raiders were given the task to land on a very small island across the channel called Tulagi. And ironically, initially, Vandegrift and his Marine Division did not run into overwhelming opposition when they first landed on D-Day, August 7th, 1942, on Guadalcanal. Now, later, of course, it erupted into some really ferocious fighting. But initially, they didn't run into much resistance. However, Edson's Raiders on Tulagi had a heck of a fight until they were able to secure the island. It took about 2 or 3 days. So it was so fortunate then that Vandegrift had chosen Edson's raiders to go in and take Tulagi. That was really where the Special Forces Japanese had been housed. And they were on this smaller island across the channel. So as the war, though, wore on, it became obvious that greater and greater numbers of Marines were needed to take these islands. And as the war progressed and they began to go from one island to another, the islands were much more heavily fortified. They ran into places where the Japanese were held up in caves. Like, for example, on Iwo Jima, the saying that you've probably heard, the Japanese were not on that island, they were in the island. And so a different type of sheer numbers, very heavy artillery, heavy mortar. It was just a different style of battle that was required. And as a result, after about 20 months, the raiders were disbanded at that particular time, folded into other Marine units.
And for listeners who really want to get a lot more context, check out the podcast Key Battles of American History that I did with James Early. We had a multi-part series on World War II in the Pacific, and there's a whole lot to this story. For those who don't know anything about the World War II Pacific Theater, like you said, Carol, I mean, the Japanese were heavily entrenched on some of these islands, and these are tiny islands. Some of these aren't even inhabited today. And if you look at the tunnels as a cross-section, they look like an ant colony. Some of them are multiple levels deep. You can't just bomb the surface. These are sophisticated networks by a fighting force that unquestionably would fight to the death, fight to starvation, and would not surrender. So yeah, very unique challenges there.
What was remarkable, Scott, about the raiders is that in the year and a half, primarily fall of 1942, and then through spring, summer, and fall of 43, the engagements that they were involved in, they performed in the most spectacular kind of way. And I'll give you just one quick example. In the fall, September, as a matter of fact, we're coming up very close to the anniversary of what's called the Battle of the Bloody Ridge, or Edson's Ridge, or in Marine terms, or people that really know about these battles, it's simply called the Ridge. And it was a 36 to 38 hour solid, ferocious battle where the raiders were outnumbered about 3-1. And in fact, the fighting at one point, the raiders had formed a horseshoe to protect. What they were doing was protecting the airfield that we had secured, Henderson Field there on Guadalcanal. And they had to form a U, sort of a horseshoe shaped, and they were back to back. The raiders were back to back fighting off hand to hand combat, and finally actually won the day, even though so outnumbered, because of their discipline, their marksmanship, and just really their sheer courage, their gut-wrenching courage during that battle. All right, so 36, 38 hours, almost solid, constant hand-to-hand battle. They were awarded later almost one Navy Cross, which is the next to the highest Medal of Honor, is the only thing higher than that. A Medal Cross was awarded to a raider about every 70, 75 minutes during that entire battle. The number of Medals of Honor, the number of ships that were named after raiders, far exceeds percentage-wise any other unit in the Marine Corps during World War II. And that tells you a little bit about how incredible they really were, their training, their sheer courage, and their skill in what they did. Fire discipline, marksmanship, all of these various things. So Marine Raiders is just an incredible story that is not really very well known. There have been a few books that have been written about them, but they, just like I was, I had heard of them, but I had no idea the story.
For the U.S. military, what qualities did they look for in Marine Raiders as they were putting together this special operations unit, and how did they train them?
Well, at this time, they had selected some very, very interesting commanders to command the initial 1st and 2nd Battalion. 3rd and 4th came along a little bit later. And Merritt Edson commanded 1st Battalion. A man by the name of Evans Carlson commanded 2nd Battalion. So some of your listeners may have heard of Edson's Raiders and then Carlson's Raiders, 1st and 2nd Battalions. And they would look for a young man who displayed a kind of confidence in themselves. They said they really were not looking for people that were displayed like bravado, too much bravado, or maybe even a sort of a false sense of patriotism or just a adventure, that kind of thing. They were really looking for young men that had sort of a self-confidence, that were physically already in pretty good condition. So they used a lot of young men, actually farm boys, that were very hardy, healthy, physically fit. They pulled in a lot of young men who participated in athletics, perhaps in high school or even in the first year of college. So it was a mental attitude as well as a physical attitude. And the training was just so intense. Both Edson and Carlson believed in a lot of walking. I mean, we're talking 25, 50 miles, full packs. We're talking about resting just a few minutes and then turning around and doing the same thing, going over the same terrain at night, so that they would learn to function as well in darkness as in daytime. They had to become excellent swimmers. We think of everybody sort of swimming today, but back in the 30s and 40s, a lot of people, they would grow up maybe not even knowing how to swim, but they had to learn to be excellent swimmers. They had to learn to be excellent boatsmen in terms of the rubber boats and marksmanship. They worked on marksmanship practically round the clock. I read one account of someone who was at Quantico when some of the Raiders were training there and getting ready. Edson was getting them ready. And he said he had seen them work all day. And then he was in the gym just shooting around some baskets that night. And here the Raiders came in to start 10 o'clock at night to work until 2 o'clock in the morning on calisthenics and sparring and knife fighting. So it was just a very, very intense training to get these Raiders ready to do what they wound up doing. Incredible story.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Ray, I mean, it's very dangerous close quarter combat that is not part of the, if you're a typical grunt who goes to boot camp for the Army and fighting in Europe, these Raiders are facing very different circumstances.
You're exactly right on that. The little stiletto knife that I told you about became sort of like a Raider trademark. It's a very thin knife. Now, a blade has a very wicked thin blade to it, very sharp. And in the jungles, they actually found that they sort of disintegrated pretty rapidly, but they would then turn to the larger K-bar, what's called a K-bar knife. But a lot of Raiders carried both. They would carry the K-bar in a leather sheath and then tuck that little wicked small 7-inch blade behind it, the stiletto behind it. And accounts that I've read said that they trained the Raiders so long and so hard with these knives that some of them became almost as good. P.T. Barnum and Bailey Circuses the circus was very well known at that time, and the knife throwers. And they said they became as proficient. They could have joined the circus had not it worked out in the Marines for them, because they became so proficient with knife throwing and with fighting with the knives. So it's really quite a story. And I don't know if you knew or not, or had reached the end of the book, but in 2006, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld laid the groundwork for the Marine Corps to again have a special forces unit. All the other branches of our service by this time have special forces units, but not the Marine Corps. How interesting and ironic, since they were really one of the first to have this larger, really organized units of special forces. But in 2006, through a series of events and after a few years, special forces units were reinstated in the Marine Corps. And in 2014, the Commandant finally granted, at the behest of many of these remaining World War II Raider warriors, to actually reinstate the name as Raider. So today, the special forces in the Marine Corps are now Marine Raiders. So they live again. Isn't that the neatest story?
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder for someone like myself who hasn't served, when you hear about Marines, your imagination just thinks, oh, they're all special forces. They don't need one. That's just what a Marine is. But when it comes to actual combat, that's not how things work on the ground for obvious reasons. So tell me about some of the personal narratives that you dug out as you were researching this and the stories of some of these raiders.
All right. What I decided to do, since there were four battalions, I had never seen a book that was written where you took one Marine raider from each battalion and you dived down into his story and allowed his story then to speak for whatever battalion he was in. So I had someone deep into the story of a young raider from 1st Battalion, one from 2nd Battalion, one 3rd Battalion, and one from 4th Battalion. And I tell their story as they entered the Marines, how they became a raider, what happened to them on the battlefield. What made this so absolutely wonderful and so neat and just my honor and privilege is that three of those four, I was able to interview personally. They were still living as I wrote the book. Now, unfortunately, two of them passed away not very long ago. One actually on Veterans Day. Oh, what a wonderful thing. I mean, hated that he had to pass, but it just was an unbelievable thing for that to be the day. But one of them is still alive, and he celebrated his 100th birthday last December, coming up on 101 years old this coming December. So I was the last to be able to actually speak with and record the stories of three of them. The fourth one, the family had every letter that this particular raider had written to them from the battlefield of Guadalcanal. I had all of his letters and I had his mother's personal journal diary entries. And so from those letters, I was able then to present his story in a very personal way as well. It just worked out beautifully. And like I say, I researched it for about 4 years and then it took me about 14 months to write Marine Raiders. But it has been quite a project, the most challenging I've ever done.
Can you tell me about some of the most important engagements? You've mentioned a few of them, capturing and keeping Henderson Field, but what were other things that you think were the most important contributions they made to the overall war effort?
Right. Well, as I mentioned, on the very first D-Day, August 7th, 1942, which was the very first of the ground offensive in the Pacific at the beginning of World War II. So the raiders were able to take Tulagi, which was across the channel from Guadalcanal. Then about a month later, they came to Guadalcanal and they were able to keep the Japanese from retaking Henderson Field during the Battle of the Bloody Ridge or the Ridge. There was another incredible patrol that's called the Long Patrol because it lasted for just a little over 30 days. And that was Carlson's Raiders. And they also were able to protect Henderson Field. And during that long patrol, they were also able to take out a very, what they call Pistol Pete, which was, had been shelling the field, not really causing that much damage, but it was, they really wanted to get that Japanese gun placement taken out. And they did that during that. They also were instrumental in landing on later on New Georgia. And then the last that the Raiders fought under the flag of being Marine Raiders was at Bougainville. And again, very instrumental in the landing there at Bougainville.
So what eventually led to them being dissolved? Was it because the island hopping campaign had ended and they were no longer needed? Or what was the reason for that?
No, the island hopping campaign was continuing on. It was just that by this time you were dealing with so many thousands and thousands of troop Japanese, and you just needed thousands more. I mean, we had a couple of divisions of Marines at that point. And so you no longer needed these units of light, fast-moving, raiding-type units. You had to come in with all your heavy equipment, all your heavy firepower, just to be able to land on the beaches of these as they progressed up the ladder toward the main island of Japan, places like Guam and later Okinawa. So the nature of the war had changed. It just required far more troop and far heavier weapons and materiel than the raiders had. Like I say, they were lightly armed. They were trained to be fast moving, to come in and do the raids and come back out. So just the nature of the war itself was changing, just requiring more of all of those things I just mentioned.
Right. And just for context for listeners, could you remind us again what time period approximately were the Marine raiders operational?
Okay. The Commandant Holcomb, activated the 1st Marine Raider Battalion on February 16th, 1942. He activated the 2nd Battalion on February 19th, just 3 days later, 1942. Then 3rd Raider Battalion and 4th Raider Battalion came online a few months later during the summer of 42. They were disbanded in December of 1943, January 19, in that time frame, end of the year, 1943. So as far as operational, they were about 20 months and engaged in approximately a dozen, maybe 13 engagements where they really, really fought as Marine Raiders. All of those raiders were then folded into these larger Marine divisions and, of course, continued to perform brilliantly, as did all of our Marines.
And the reason I ask, just for context for listeners, that in the Pacific Theater, what changes is that for Japanese strategy, from after Pearl Harbor until maybe 42, 43, they believe that they can at least have a peace settlement with the United States and maintain their empire on their terms. But by 1944, when it becomes clear that they can't hope for, that's when fighting gets very vicious and very ugly, hoping that they'll horrify the United States and drag out the war long enough that they won't invade the mainland, because they'll be terrified at the prospect of, if it takes this much effort to take a small island like Okinawa, what would it take to occupy the mainland too? But overall, in general, a point that you make is that with the Marine Raiders, you note that their history has been obscured despite their feats. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that it's just the nature of a smaller force, that simply as the war went on, the battles were so large, the names became so well known. I mean, if asked someone, had they ever heard of, probably not, but it was a spectacular battle and win for the U.S. And it was Edson's Raiders, along with there were some Marine paratroopers that were part of that. And there was a couple of units of Marines that were in there as well. But primarily it was Edson's Raiders that took Tulagi. But most people just have not heard of Tulagi. But many people have heard of Iwo Jima, as rightly they should. Iwo was just an unbelievable battle, and our Marines were magnificent in it. So I think it's just a matter of, just not a lot has been written about the World War II Raiders, and hopefully this book will help change some of that. So it's been already very well received, I am very pleased to say, as well it should be. And maybe you could speak to this too, Scott. Generally speaking, I think the average person probably knows more about World War II in Europe than they do World War II in the Pacific. Would you agree with me probably on that?
Oh, absolutely. I solicit questions from my audience all the time, and about 20% of them are hypothetical Hitler questions, as I call them. Like, what if Hitler had the atomic bomb? What if Hitler had Superman X-ray vision? Just something really weird, alternate history, Nazi stuff. So much of that out there.
If you think about it, I mentioned that D-Day in the Pacific was August 7th, 1942. That was 8 months to the day after Pearl Harbor. Now, granted, we were in North Africa, My dad was in North Africa, as a matter of fact, and then Sicily, and then Italy, up the boot of Italy with General Mark Clark. But the landing at Normandy is the thing that I think most people think of as our real entry into the war in Europe. And that was, of course, not until 1944. So we were already been fighting in the Pacific for 2 years, really fighting, ferocious fighting in the Pacific. And not only that, but we fought in the Pacific past the surrender of the Germans. So it's interesting. And there are probably a lot of reasons why more people know about Europe. I think more people have visited Europe. And so they've been to France, they've been to Italy, and not many people have been to Guadalcanal. When in fact, when we got into the war, one of the things I say in the book, and this is documented, there were naval commanders that started scrambling for maps and, you know, where the heck is Guadalcanal? And in point of fact, there were less than 1,000 settlers that were on in the Solomon missionaries. Missionaries were there. It was a British protectorate. You had some British that were there. But other than that, you had Melanesians. You had native tribes that lived there. So it is interesting, I think, that but the war in the Pacific is really unbelievable and fascinating on so many different levels.
Yeah, I mean, just talking about this from a big picture standpoint, I agree with how you framed it, that Europe is more relatable. I think for those who do want to study it, it's more enjoyable. The Pacific theater was vicious, and to properly understand it, I mean, you're looking at really inhumane things happening in POW camps, what soldiers go through, everything else. But with the post-World War II global order that resulted, what happened in the Pacific theater is equally, and some would argue, more important than what happened in the European theater, but that's a whole other discussion. But to get back to your specific topic at hand, other than the Marine Raiders being resurrected, and it is once again the special forces of the Marines, what else would you point to as their legacy?
I talk about this in the book. I think their training and the discipline that they had, their skill level at marksmanship, hand-to-hand combat, all of those kinds of things, fast-moving, working so decidedly in as small teams, warring teams coming in, amphibious landings, those sort of things. They laid a foundation of excellence for any subsequent special forces that would be formed. And we see that. We see that in our military. We see that in fact, even in other armies. The British commandos have worked very closely with our current Marine Raiders when they first got started, as a matter of fact, back in the 2006, 2007. So these World War II Raiders, I think you could even say, helped to set the bar, and it was very high. And to have a heritage like that for these young Raiders, to have a heritage like that is really incredible.
Well, for military history buffs, of which many who listen to this show are, I think they'll really enjoy getting into the story more. And for those who want to check it out, the name of the book is Marine Raiders, The True Story of the Legendary World War II Battalions. Carol, thank you for joining us.
Oh, Scott, thank you so much. My pleasure.
All right, that is all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes for this and all my other episodes and include sources, maps, or other relevant information, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. Parthenon is the name of the podcast network that History Unplugged is a part of, along with other great history shows like James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. This really helps the show grow. The second thing is to join our membership program on Patreon. And if you do so, you can get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog of the show, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening and see you next time.